Habakkuk, tape 2.
So that brings us this morning then to Habakkuk chapter 1. Habakkuk chapter 1, which we've called frustration. Now let me give a little background again, and this time nail down more specifically the things that caused the frustration in the prophet Habakkuk. His faith was a suffering faith. He was under a tremendous strain, a strain of mystery. When faith can't see clearly, it's in trouble. You see, the whole object of faith is that faith can see better than eyes. You say, I can walk in the dark, I can't see with these eyes, but my faith can see. But when you've got trouble with the eyes of your faith, then you're in real trouble. And that's where Habakkuk was. The eyes of his faith were dim. And he was longing that God would clear out his eyes, his real eyes, the eyes of his heart. One of the mistakes that Habakkuk made was trying to line up the ways of God with human logic. And you realize when you try to line up what God does with our understanding, you come into some trouble. I like the comment Peter made in the second epistle that he wrote, chapter 3, 16. He was talking about the scriptures and he said, in which we have some things hard to understand. Hard to understand. You see, when you're dealing with God, or when you're dealing with the ways of God, or when you're dealing with His book, there's always going to be those things that Peter says are hard to understand. And it has to be that way. What kind of an inspiration would it be if this book contained nothing hard to understand? You see, the whole idea is that it's the inspired Word of God. We say and believe that God is incomprehensible. That is, He's way beyond our ability to understand it. Now, if that's true, we can't expect God's revelation of Himself to present a God that's comprehensible. God is incomprehensible, and the revelation of that God must be an incomprehensible revelation. If the Bible explained everything, God, to the size of our understanding, it would prove itself false. It would show that it's a human book and not a divine book. It would explain a God that it claims can't be explained, and so it's an impossibility. God is forever a mystery to the highest of all created intelligences. We can't even understand ourselves. We can't begin to know ourselves. We shrink back from scrutinizing our bodies, all the systems of our bodies, the respiratory system and the nervous system and the reproductive system and the digestive system. We don't understand all of that. Let alone our soul, our spirit. We can't understand ourselves. And so when we come to God, Habakkuk, you better learn this, many things are going to be hard to understand. Now that's not a hardship on faith. That's the stamp that it's divine. It's a proof that it's not a human book. Well anyway, Habakkuk had been tripped up on things that were hard to understand. Before I give God's answers to the frustrations that he expressed, let me try to nail down for you the two big things that caused him so much problem. Habakkuk chapter 1 expresses two things that troubled Habakkuk so much. The first can be summarized in this expression, unjudged sin. Habakkuk couldn't understand why God wouldn't judge sin. Let's read verses 1 through 4. The oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw, how long, O Lord, will I call for help, and wilt thou not hear? I cry out to thee, violence, yet thou dost not save. Why dost thou make me see iniquity, and cause me to look on wickedness? Destruction and violence are before me, strife exists, contention arises. Therefore the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. The wicked surround the righteous. Therefore justice becomes perverted. comes out perverted. How the prophet puzzled over that. Sin prevails far and prospers long. And I don't understand it, Lord. Why doesn't God do something? With all this sin around, is he blind? Is he deaf? Is he not aware of what's going on? Doesn't he know? Can't he observe, like I've expressed in verse 3, wickedness and strife? Didn't he say in his Bible, blessed are the peacemakers? Well, is the opposite true? Cursed are the peacebreakers? Then why doesn't he judge? Why doesn't he curse the sinners? And then again in verse 4, the injustice. Look at our court system. Look at our public officials. They ignore right and wrong. There's no law, there's no standard, there's no principle, there's no justice. Doesn't God see that? Now see, that's what Habakkuk was facing. He looked all around him, and everyone was sinning and having a good time, and it looked like God was approving of it because of his inactivity. Why does he allow these things to go unchecked? Verse 4 says that the righteous are swallowed up by the wicked, that the wicked prevail. There was an unbelievable oppression going on. And the thing that grieved Habakkuk's heart was the fact that it looked like God was giving countenance to all these things, that God wasn't going to deal with it at all. And so seeing this awful iniquity that was reigning unchecked just pressed down on the prophet's struggling faith, and he cried out and said, Lord, I don't understand unjudged sin. They curse your name. They laugh about you. They kill the people of God. They hate right. They call darkness light and light darkness. And you just sit there. And you send us out and they don't listen to us. You tell us to present your word and to stand up for your name, and we're mocked and we're tread down. Why, Lord? Why don't you do something? And so this faith had a real inward strain. The second problem Habakkuk had that frustrated him, I think more than the first one, he was frustrated all right by the iniquity of God's people. But the thing that frustrated him more was God's instrument of chastening. The instrument God was going to use. Verse 6, God says, behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. And when he said, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, the old prophet's heart sunk. Especially after God described them in that chapter. Now we can read these things and just say, oh yeah, la la la. Oh, if we could only enter the spirit of ancient Babylon. They were wicked. They were warlike, violent, cruel, heartless. They could care less about anything. War is cruel all the time. But when a nation as wicked as Babylon comes to the throne, you better get out of the way. And that's what was happening. The Chaldeans were a violent nation. And God says, I'm raising them up. And Habakkuk looked at God and he said, what? You're going to use Babylon? Why, they're more wicked than we are. And it was a disturbing thing. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. Let me show you from verses 12 through 17 how Habakkuk pours out that complaint to God. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Thou, O Lord, hast appointed them to judge. And now, O Rock, has established them to correct. Thine eyes are too pure to approve evil. Thou canst not look on wickedness with favor. Why dost thou look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why art thou silent when the wicked are swallowed up, those more righteous than they? Now, let me read that again. I missed the point. Why art thou silent when the wicked swallowed up those more righteous than men? Why hast thou made men like the fish of the sea, like the creeping thing without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net. gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and they're glad. They offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large and their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? My Lord, verse 13, you're too holy to use such an instrument as this. Why, the rod is worse than the back that it tears. Why are you using such an instrument? And then verse 14 through 17, why do you regard us as impersonally as fish? Here's the illustration. When a man goes fishing, he has no compassion on the fish. He catches a fish with a hook, and let's say that the hook is lodged in its gill. The man loves the hook more than the fish, and he'll do an awful lot on that fish to get the hook out. He'll tear at the fish and tug, and he'll cut his mouth and throat, and he doesn't have any compassion. Am I right? You're a fisherman, Pat. Is that true? He covers his face. And so what the prophet is saying is this, that Israel are like fish and Babylon's like the fishermen. They just throw in the line and they hook them. They don't care who they hook. Or they throw out the net and they drag them in and throw them in the bottom of the boat. They don't care anything about God's people. And Habakkuk said, God, are you going to let them do that? They have no compassion. They have no mercy. We're just like fish, and we have no opportunity to escape. And then in verse 16, he says, Lord, don't you care about your own glory? You say you're going to use them, but look at verse 16. They offer a sacrifice to their net. Same as to say, they're not going to give you the glory for that. They're going to go out and take in a whole nation with their net. And then they're going to praise their own army. And they're going to praise their own God, and they're going to praise their own right hand, and they're going to worship themselves. You won't get glory from this. You think Babylon's going to bow down and say, look what God did, he gave us Israel. Habakkuk couldn't understand it. And his heart was just grieved, and his faith was suffering. Now, I don't want you to be too hard on the prophet, because he's expressing our own hearts. He was puzzled by the ways of God. At first he fretted over unjudged sin, and God answered that problem. But that answer didn't bring him any relief. The point is, the fact is, the answer brought him more burden and added to him. Now Habakkuk is grieving over the unholy stick in the hand of a holy God. He said, I want you to deal with sin, Lord, but not that way, please. Doesn't that compromise your holiness, Habakkuk said? Doesn't that violate your heart of compassion to allow that? Doesn't that detract from your glory? Lord, I thought your heart was set on holiness, compassion, glory. If you go that route, then you're going to be acting unholy, not compassionate, and you're going to lose glory. Don't just read these things and say, oh boy, that was his problem. He really had a big problem. These are not shallow questions that Habakkuk was asking. He was calling on God from the depths of his being. His faith, he wanted to believe. He wanted to trust God, but he had these problems. He couldn't understand the ways of God. How a holy God could let sin go on like that without being judged, without being checked. He just couldn't understand that. These were things hard to be understood, and so he poured them out before the Lord. One thing I love about the way Habakkuk handled his suffering faith was this, that he handled it privately before God. He poured out his suspicions, but not before men. He poured out his suspicions before God. He admitted mystery, and then he waited for God's answer. He didn't accuse God before men. It was a shocking message he had from God. Let me read these verses, 6 through 11a. Behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people, who march throughout the earth, now watch this army, to seize dwelling places which are not theirs, They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping down to devour. All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. They mock at kings, and rulers are a laughter to them. Laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. I call Habakkuk chapter 1 frustration. Struggling faith, suffering faith. Habakkuk wanted to believe, and soon he will. He'll get to Fortissimo. God's going to bring him there. But we begin the book this way. Now, in order to make this chapter clear and practical, you don't want a history lesson. We don't want to just study an old prophet that's been dead and gone for hundreds of years. What I'd like to show you are some principles. Actually, the chapter, it isn't only chapter 1. It goes through chapter 2, verse 3. Chapter 1:1 through chapter 2:3, we'll just call frustration. We've already looked at his problem and God's answer, and then his problem again and God's answer. So this time what I'd like to do is go through the chapter and outline it in terms of principles. And I find 6 wonderful principles dealing with things hard to be understood from chapter 1. 6 wonderful principles that are designed to dispel the clouds of frustration. That are designed to soothe suffering faith. God is going to bring him from frustration to fortissimo. And in order to do it, he lays down in principle form in chapter 1 some of those insights into the ways and the dealings of God. They're designed to lift the prophet's spirit, and by the time we get out of chapter 1, he's a little bit lifted. He's got a long way to go, and God will bring him there in chapter 2, but he's taking a giant step forward. So I want to give you then these 6 principles. They're always true in every age and generation, and I believe they're all designed to strike at the nerve center of frustration. So if you're frustrated in any way today, I hope Habakkuk chapter 1 helps you. All right, let's begin. I'll state each principle and then try to develop it. The first principle may be stated in these words, the burdens of my heart are from the Lord. The burdens of my heart are from the Lord. Habakkuk was grieved with terrible sin, the unjudged iniquity of God's people. But where did he get that burden? You think he just all of a sudden looked out there and said, oh, I hate sin? No, what? Verse 3. Why dost thou make me see iniquity? God opened his eyes. Now, you just take some Christians. Don't go judging anybody now. I don't mean that. Not people you know. But look at the church as a whole. Are all God's people grieving over sin? Unjust sin? See, they're not. But God burdens some to do that. You see, the burden came from God. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the oracle, or the burden which Habakkuk the prophet saw. It isn't one he drummed up, one he made. It's a burden that he saw from God. God is the one that gave him this burden. Now, often we misinterpret Psalm 37:4. Psalm 37:4 says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he'll give you the desires of your heart. We generally take that to mean he'll give you whatever your heart desires. But that's not what it says. It doesn't say he'll give you what your heart desires. It says he'll give you the desires of your heart. The desires of your heart. The burdens of your heart. Where'd you get them? You can just make them up. If you're burdened this morning, or whenever you're listening to this tape, if you're burdened, where did you get that burden? Well, the Bible gives a clear answer. It came from the Lord. In this connection, I love Psalm 55:2. rather 55:22. And because of an important marginal note, I'm going to ask you to look up Psalm 55. Otherwise, I'd just quote it for you, but I want you to see the marginal note. Psalm 55, please. Verse 22. For those of you that like silly associations, you can remember this one easily because 22 is just 55 turned around, upside down, you know. So you can just think 55:22. That's how I remembered it. Nancy's checking it out. Okay. First, let me just give you the verse. 55:22 says, "Cast your burden upon the Lord, and He will sustain you." And you notice that there's a marginal note on the word burden. Look it up. And in the margin it says, "What He has given you." All right, that marvels. Cast your burden on the Lord. Cast what He has given you upon the Lord, and He'll sustain you. The burden that you cast on the Lord is the burden that He has given you. God doesn't burden you in order to frustrate you. Habakkuk was burdened and he turned frustrated. God didn't burden him to frustrate him. But when God is about to move, when God is about to act, when God is about to do something, He burdens somebody. And He means that they should cast their burden upon the Lord, that which He gives them. We often talk about prayer burden. And it's a wonderful thing to be burdened by God. Well, Habakkuk was burdened because of reigning sin. And so he prayed. A burden is two things. It's always two things. Number one, it's a call to trust in the Lord. Every time you get a burden, you're called to trust in the Lord. Now, sometimes that call takes the form of prayer. Sometimes it doesn't. It always takes the form of faith. You're always called to cast your burden on the Lord. But a burden is something else. It's not only a call to trust in the Lord, it's also a prophecy from the Lord. You say, well, what do you mean by that? God will never burden your heart to ask for what will not be granted. He's not going to mock you. The burden is God's way of involving you in His program, in His work, in His activity. And so He burdens you, He puts it on you, in order that you might call upon Him and trust in Him and cast it upon Him, and all of a sudden you're involved in the work. That's how Habakkuk got involved, that tremendous burden God laid on him. Now, all of the prophets, you see the same thing. The burden which the Lord gave to me, the oracle which God put upon me, God is getting them involved in the work. Nothing would ever be done in this world if God didn't burden people. That's how God gets you into it. He lays a burden on you. But the point is that you're not supposed to be burdened with the burdens. Habakkuk was burdened with the burden. God burdens you in order that you might cast what He's given you back upon Him. That's what it means to pray in the Spirit. Pray the burdens that the Spirit writes upon your heart. Those inclinations that you have, those desires, the things you want to see God do, you didn't just come up with those. God put those in your heart. He puts that burden on there. You say, well, I wish God would do such and such. He put that burden there. So now you cast that burden on Him and then watch Him do it. It's a call to trust. It's also a prophecy. And I believe this is also true, that the greater the burden, Habakkuk would say the greater the frustration. No, the greater the burden, the greater will be the miracle of God when He finally answers. Don't worry how long He delays. That burden is not yours. He has laid that upon you in order to involve you in His program. So when you're burdened for loved ones, for parents, for family, for neighbors, for some work of God, Well, don't make that a frustration. Just say, oh boy, I'm so burdened, this guy never gets it. Say, Lord, thank you for that burden. You put that on me, an opportunity to trust you, a guarantee that you're going to do something. I'll just keep casting that burden on you until you come through. These are the ways of God. And so Habakkuk begins to learn that burdens shouldn't burden, that they're designed to drive you to the Lord, to cast your burden on Him. All right, that's the first principle I see that militates against frustration. Burdens are from God. Habakkuk was burdened, but it wasn't from his own making. God put that on him. The second principle may be stated in these words. God is active. God is working. God is doing something. You see, one of the temptations facing Habakkuk was that God was a do-nothing God. He was idle. He was passive. He wasn't involved. He wasn't doing anything. He didn't learn that God does things through us. And burdens involve us in the work, and God's going to do something. He just saw God sitting back doing nothing. Look at chapter 1 again, please, in verse 5. God answers Habakkuk's first complaint, and he says, look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I am doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. Oh, isn't it a marvelous verse? I love Habakkuk 1:5. I am doing something in your days you would not believe it if you were told. First, I was confused about what that unbelievable work was that God is doing. See, it's not just saying God is active, but He's busy doing something, a wondrous something. He says, look and wonder, I am doing something, an unbelievable something. There's a principle here which may be seen more clearly by comparing Habakkuk 1:5 with Acts chapter 13, where it's quoted. Let me illustrate that for you. In Habakkuk 1:5, it's clear what God is doing. Verse 6 tells you, I am raising up the Chaldeans. The unbelievable work was raising up the Chaldeans. But be honest with me now. Does that sound unbelievable? Sound like a big build-up. Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder. I'm doing an unbelievable thing. I'm raising up the Chaldeans. It doesn't sound so dramatic, so unbelievable. I can understand that God would do that. And so I read Acts 13. I'm going to ask you to turn there for a moment, please. Because he quotes Habakkuk. Oh, by the way, you'd be interested to know that Habakkuk is only 3 chapters deep. But it's one of the most quoted books in the New Testament. It's quoted over and over again. I've forgotten now, 7 or 8 times it's quoted. But Acts 13, if you look at verse 16, you'll get the context. Paul stood up motioning with his hands and said, men of Israel, you who fear God. This is when Paul was on his first missionary journey and went to Pisidian Antioch, and they said, if you have anything to say, then tell us. And he begins to preach. And as he preaches, he gets into the cross. 28. And there they found no ground for prayer. They asked Pilate that he be executed. And when they had carried out all that was written concerning him, they took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb. And in his sermon, he begins to show how wicked men, and not only wicked men, Satan, opposed the Son of God and drove him to the cross. And how Jesus, by wicked hands, was crucified, how he died and was buried, and how God raised him up. And then in verse 40, he says, take heed, therefore, so that the things spoken in the prophets may not come upon you. Behold, you scoffers, marvel. He doesn't say, and wonder this time. He says, and perish. For I am accomplishing a work in your days, a work which you will never believe, though someone should describe it to you. Alright, let's put it together and see if we can come up with that wondrous, unbelievable work that God is doing. In the Old Testament, God was using wicked Babylon to chasten his people Israel. That's clear. In the New Testament, God was using wicked men, even Satan, in order to put his own son on the cross, through which, as you well know, God has brought a blessing to the entire world. You see the principle? What a weapon against frustration this is. Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, I'm doing something in your days which you would not believe if you were told. Here's what it is. God's wonderful, unbelievable work is this, that he is making the wicked praise him, that he is bringing good out of evil. God said, I know you don't see it. You wouldn't believe. You look out there, you see all the injustice, and you see sin, and you see oppression, and you see nations, and people mocking me, and cursing me, and going against me. It's hard to believe, isn't it, that I'm using all of that for good. And God says, but I want you to know, no matter how bad it looks out there, they're all working in my hand. I am using that. I'm doing a work. If I explain it to you, you wouldn't believe it. You can't believe I'm using that unjust court system. You wouldn't believe that I'm using that drug scene that you see out there. That I'm using all of the immorality. That I'm using wicked nations. That I was in charge of Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin and Marx. That I raised them up. You wouldn't believe that. But he says, I did. I want you to know, Habakkuk, you're frustrated because you think I'm a do-nothing God. Well, I am working, and you wouldn't believe it if I told you. Because I am using all of these things to accomplish my own purposes. All of the sin and injustice and prejudice and oppression, all the selfishness, everything. Now I can say with Habakkuk, yeah, that I can't believe. That is an unbelievable thing. When I see the sin out there, it's hard to believe that God is working. But he is. 6. Back in Habakkuk 1, he says, I am raising up the Chaldeans. Before we leave this unbelievable work, let me ask this question. God says, I am raising up the Chaldeans. How does he do that? How does he do that? Does he instigate them? Does he stir them up? No, because that would make him the author of sin. That would make him to blame for their wickedness. He said, I'm raising them up. How does he do it? Does he coerce them? Force them? Against the will. You say, no, that would go against what is clearly taught in the Bible, that God never forces. God never strong arms. God never goes against your will. He raises them up, but he's not the instigator. He's not the source of their wickedness. He raises them up, but he doesn't coerce them. He doesn't force them. How does he raise them up? The answer is simple. He raises them up by permitting them. You follow that? He raises them up by permitting them. He could prevent them. He could stop them if he wanted to. But he allows them. He permits them to go their own way. One tremendous illustration of this is Isaiah chapter 10. I'm doing a lot of donkey work today, but I'm going to ask you to turn there too. Isaiah chapter 10. Change illustrations. It's no longer Babylon, it's now Assyria. The fact is the same. Assyria will become the whip in the hand of God to punish, chasten his people. Isaiah 10:6. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation. I commission it against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder, to trample them down like mud in the streets, God said, Assyria, you're in trouble. I am going to use you to wipe out my people. And then he says, verse 7, yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and cut off many nations. In other words, Assyria has no idea in the world that they're being used of God. Their desire is just to kill, to plunder, to destroy. And God says, yes, but I'm using them. So God raises them up by permitting them, by allowing them. He doesn't coerce them. He doesn't force their will. He's surely not the instigator, the source of sin. So the first two things, first two principles I see that militate against frustration. Number one, all burdens are from God. Number two, God is working. Boy, if that doesn't chase frustration away, to know that, God is working. The third principle is found in chapter 1, verse 11. It's clearly seen in the New American Standard, not quite so clear in the King James. I just call it the big but. The big but. They will sweep through like the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty. You don't see that clearly in the King James. And if you think that maybe the New American Standard or the other revised versions missed the point, don't despair, because it's the same truth that's taught in the five rows of chapter 2. So whether it's taught in 111 or not, it is taught in this book. In chapter 2, woe to Babylon. I'm going to use them, but they're in trouble. I'm going to use them to punish my people, but then I'm going to get them for touching my people. You see? Woe. These two things we learn from this great but. Number one, wickedness will not prevail forever. Habakkuk, you don't need to be frustrated. Wickedness will not prevail forever. God doesn't reveal all his purposes. He tells us some of them. He's patient. He's kind. He's long-suffering, not willing that any should perish. He waits till the iniquity is full before he judges. He bears long, but not forever. And there'll be a day when he'll have to judge. And woe be to those who have abused his patience when he finally lets down the boom. Wickedness will not prevail forever. But there's another truth on that big but, and that is chastening will not last forever. Boy, I tell you, there's some joy in that. Chastening will not last forever. With the punishment of the wicked comes the blessing, the release of God's chastened people. In this connection, I love Micah 7, 18. Remember when we went through Micah? Chapter 7, 18. He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in unchanging love. Just forget Habakkuk for a minute. Just think about frustration. How frustration would be removed if people believed just these three things. There's others, but just these three things. Number one, that the burden they have is from God. Number two, that God is working even though they don't see it. Number three, that what they're going through now will not last forever. What a tremendous comfort that God, he's going to bring them to Fortissimo. I guarantee you he's going to, and he's going to be present up. But he drops these little nuggets in the way in order to lay down these principles, not only for Habakkuk, but for Ed Miller, 1979, when I have those same heart murmurings that Habakkuk had. All right, let's look at a couple more. The fourth principle. Four principles illustrated from the wonderful verses 12 and 13. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. Thou, O Lord, hast appointed them to judge. And thou, O Rock, hast established them to correct. Thine eyes are too pure to approve evil. Thou canst not look on wickedness with favor. Notice verse 12. his vision of the Lord, Thou art from everlasting. O Lord, my God. Notice he doesn't say the Holy One. My Holy One. I don't know any place else in the Bible where God is called my Holy One. Habakkuk calls God my Holy One. What a personal relationship. You see, I'm trying to illustrate, I'll state the principle in a moment, that Habakkuk, though he had suffering faith, had a tremendous view of the character of God. My Holy One. And it's from this high view of God's character that he blurts out that little expression. First, I thought it was out of place in verse 12. We will not die. We will not die. Now, what do you mean by that? We will not die. I believe it's a remnant truth. And he begins to meditate on the Lord and he says, O Lord, Thou art from everlasting. Thou art high. Thou art my Holy One. We won't die. Now I see it. I understand. We're not all going to be destroyed. Let me state the principle. But if it doesn't drive frustration away, God's character is a resting place. God's character interprets God's conduct. But when I don't understand God's conduct, I can still rest in God's character. My Holy One. We will not die. Now, in order to illustrate this and drive home its truth, I'd like to illustrate it from the book of Job. But you don't need to turn there. I'll just quote one verse. It's a verse that recently has made more sense to me. It's Job 13:16 when he said, Though he slay me... Can you finish it? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Oh, wait a minute. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. David saying, I will sing unto the Lord because the Lord has dealt bountifully with me. But Job's went far beyond that. It's easy to say, I'll sing because he's dealt bountifully with me. But Job sang. He had songs in the night. Though he slay me. That isn't bountiful dealing. It is rightly understood. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. You see, Job saw the character of God and interpreted God's actions by what he saw in that character. For years, I thought Job said that in desperation. You know, the idea being, well, I have nothing else to do. Everything's wiped out. The bottom fell out. Last resort, at least I can trust God, you know. And sort of run to him as a last hope. No, when Job said, though he slay me, yet shall I trust him, there's no desperation in that. It's all positive. It's all joy. Let me illustrate. There's always a relationship between character and conduct. And you're familiar with that. We often say that conduct is the voice of character. What a man is determines what a man does. We've expressed it so many times. If I see a man constantly stealing, that's his action. I watch him, he always steals. After a while, I'm going to conclude he's a thief. You see, that's not deep. But I determined his character by what I saw him do. I keep watching him steal. After a while, I say he is a thief. And because he is a thief, he will steal. If a man throws himself out in the front lines, I might conclude he is brave. He is patriotic. The deed without the character, of course, is very unsatisfying. If someone, and of course we don't want to judge hearts, but you can almost taste it. Someone does something nice for you and you know their heart's not in it. You know they don't really mean it. They give you something, they smile, glad to see you, and you know that they can't stand you or something like that. And you know their actions are not backed up by their character. There's a relationship between character and conduct. Here's how it usually works. It usually begins with conduct, not character. It begins with conduct. We see a man who constantly does honest things. He treats you honest. He treats you fairly. He's in business. He does honest things. And after a while, in your mind, you're forming his character. And then you finally come to the conclusion, there's an honest man. You came to his character by observing his conduct. Do you see that?
Now, there might be a day when that honest man does something puzzling, something you don't understand, and the whole town comes down upon him and says, he's embezzled, he's done this, he's done that. But you have been convinced that he is an honest man, and you don't understand what he did, and you can't put your finger on his reasonings. But because you know him, because you know his character, you leave time to interpret his actions. And you say, I don't care what others say, I know he's an honest man. For years in Job's life, Job saw God doing this and God doing that and God doing that. And because he saw the actions of God, the conduct of God, Job formed an opinion, a conviction about God's character. And he said, God is holy and God is right. And then later on, when God reached down with his heavy hand and removed the hedge from around his life, Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I know his character, and I don't understand what he's doing, and it seems unfair, and it seems not right, but I'm resting in his character. I know because of who he is that what he does is okay. You follow the reasoning? We start with conduct, conduct moves to character, and then character comes back and interprets conduct. And because of who a man is, because of who God is, we know that the things he does are right. And just so Habakkuk, he didn't understand the dealings of God, but God is bringing him from frustration to fortissimo. He didn't understand his treatments, his dealings, his ways. They looked distressing, they looked puzzling, he was perplexed. But then he begins to meditate on his character. And he says, Thou art from everlasting, O Lord, my Lord, my Holy One. And all of a sudden he blurts out, we will not die. We will. Now I see. I know because of God's character that the things he does are going to come out all right. And I say that's a comfort. And Habakkuk had to learn to stop judging God by his actions and begin to rest in his character. And that chases away frustration, resting in the character of God. Let me state the next one for you. Do you see how knowing these things take away frustration? All burdens are from God. God is working, even though you don't see it. Chastening will not last forever. Who God is a resting place for everything God does. He's proved himself, and now we know he's true. And we rest in who he is, and we'll let him unfold the reasons for everything he does. We trust him. The fifth principle can be stated in these words: God has a perfect timetable. Oh, talk about driving away frustration. God has a perfect timetable. Chapter 2, after Habakkuk prays, he says, I'll stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart. I'll keep watch to see what he'll speak to me. I'm going to wait now for God and how I may reply when I'm reproved. See, Habakkuk knew he was wrong. And he said, I'm going to wait for God, and when the lightning comes, then I'll see what to do then. But then verse 2, then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision, inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. Let me tell you plainly what he's saying. He's saying, I'm about to give you an answer, Habakkuk. You asked for it, and you're going to get it. And I want you to write it on a billboard. And I want you to make the letters so big that anybody running by can read it. You don't have to stand there and look at it and say, I wonder if there's any fine print in what God has to say. He said, I want you to write this thing so big that nobody misses it. And then he begins in verse 3. The vision is yet for an appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it. It certainly will come. It will not delay. King James says, though it tarry, it will not tarry. In other words, what he's saying is, Habakkuk, I have a plan, and I've involved you in it by burden. At a certain appointed time, I'm going to do something. Wait for it. Don't tarry, because it will not tarry. It may come at the last minute, but it will never come a minute too late. The word hasten in the Greek, Hebrew rather, literally means pants toward the end. You ever see a dog running when he's panting? And what he's saying here is so tremendous. God's promises are out of breath until they be fulfilled. God's promises are panting. Be patient. God says, I've got an appointed time for everything. Habakkuk, don't jump the gun. Don't be trigger happy. Wait patiently. You can rest in my character. Though it tarry, wait for it. It will come. And in the context, the promise is clear. The promise of full deliverance and revelation of God. Wait for it. It pants in order to be fulfilled. And then the last thing, I'll just mention it, we don't have time to develop it now. The last thing, the last principle, chapter 2, verse 4. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. While you're waiting, you still have a responsibility to trust in the Lord. Why does he bring faith in here? In order to tell him what to do? Yeah, that's part of it, but here's the other part. All that God is doing is designed to purify faith. God is testing our faith by all of this. And so God gives us in Habakkuk chapter 1 at least 6 reasons. There's more here. We just touched it. But at least 6 reasons that we should never be frustrated. Number 1, burdens are from God. Number 2, God is working. Number 3, chastening will not be forever. You might have to bear it in the days ahead. But it's not forever. The sun is going to rise again. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And then God's character is a resting place. You don't have to understand his hand when you're resting in his heart. His hand will never work against his heart. And you rest in his character, and then know that God has a perfect timetable. And that everything he's ever planned for you is going to come, and the promise is out of breath waiting until it be fulfilled. And then finally, everything that God allows in your life is going to help you. It's going to purify you. He's just testing your faith, because the trial of your faith is more precious than the gold that perishes, that it might be found with praise and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Alright, God is weaning Habakkuk from frustration to fortissimo. And what he's done for him, he wants to do for us. Comments or questions about chapter 1? Alright, let's bow together. Our Father, we do rejoice that these principles we've discussed this morning are so wonderfully true. Lord, we'd ask you to make us know them, not with our heads only, but may they sink down into our ears and into our hearts, into the very life of our life, that they might become part of our being, of our character. Deliver us from frustration in all of its subtle forms, and take us forward to fortissimo. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.